You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 423 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you again in separate Washingtons.
Oh. Separate Washingtons.
I'm not in D.C., not in the other Washington.
Yeah, no. Sometimes, have you ever thought about how there's almost two Washingtons?
There are two Washingtons. We're not in the other one right now.
Separate Washingtons. You have to save that for there's going to be a time when we are coming to you from separate Washingtons.
There probably will eventually, given long enough, you'll be at some sort of baseball tournament on the other side of the mountains and we'll be in separate Washington.
Oh, no, I'm saying from Washington, D.C.
Oh,
one of us is going to be in Washington, D.C.
A city I have never visited.
I drove through it one time.
Okay. We're actually coming to you from separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, which I guess is technically still home of the first place, Seattle Mariners.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks, and all of a sudden, football seems great.
Oh, man, football is in the air. I mean, it was, like, shocking to think about it the other day and realize, like, NFL training camps are this month now?
Oh, yeah.
It does not feel like that should be right.
We're
not
a WNBA town, though.
It's true, although the WNBA will, the lights will be going out for a month here for the Olympics. It's the first time you've ever experienced a WNBA Olympic break, so it'll be new to you.
If you haven't seen it, it's new to you. Honestly,
does anyone else remember that reference?
It's the most genius marketing.
I mean, it's inevitably true. What channel even was it?
That was NBC.
Was it?
NBC was at the top of its powers, and then they came up with that shit for the summer. My God, they were unstoppable.
1998. It's new to you.
Right, though. No, I mean, I guess that was like right at the end of Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah. That was peak of their powers. I mean, Friends is
NBC
going strong.
ER. On the top of the world in 1998.
They had NBA Finals, Bulls, Jazz.
I feel like 96
which
was
is,
maybe
it
like
is, by the way,
the biggest NBC ever was, but
it is the Michael Jordan episode of the pod.
There we go.
Alas.
Beautiful. Yeah. Pulled all together. What number does Bronny wear, by the way?
What number does Bronny wear? I believe he wore 6 at USC. So LeBron is, I think, wearing that now. Anthony Davis is wearing 23. No, Anthony Davis is still wearing 3. I don't know if anyone's wearing 23 at the moment.
Maybe Bronny will wear 23.
I assume they would have like assigned him a jersey number thus far, but I don't know. He plays for the Los Angeles Lakers now. That's a thing that happened since we last talked. LeBron is wearing 23, so Bronny is free to take number 6 if he so desires. That's a thing that happened the entire NBA draft, most of free agency since we last recorded this podcast.
Are we talking about the NBA anywhere on this podcast? I have so many things to talk about, and you listed none of them in the notes.
Oh, I mean, what do you have to talk about?
I think
about?
You wanted to do Oops All Rundown, is what it says here.
This isn't listed as number 9. Maybe, no, 6 isn't retired, because LeBron was definitely going to... Lakers agree to overpay Bronny James, according to the Daily Beast. Like, they're paying him literally the minimum. What were you expecting? All right, now I see a Yahoo story. Bronny James honors Juice WRLD with number 9 jersey.
Fair enough.
All right, what did you want to... I mean, should we save that? Should we talk about that now?
The NBA?
Yeah.
Let's do the toast first, and then let's do the NBA.
Well, first up, congratulations to Baby Fantasy Genius, who was named MVP of the GSL Washington State Championships last weekend. You were there. You did not coach anything. You were just a parent. How was it?
I did some mild coaching. Like the actual coaches hate when you talk to the children. But after the first inning, he got a little rattled or whatever. He was pitching, got a little rattled, and I walked over and I was like, "You're fine." You would think that he got roughed up, and literally there was like a base runner, you know, and he's like furious on the mound. He's very, very fiery on the mound. he's the most animated pitcher, but I just want, you're fine. Everything's okay. Your team is up like 4-1 or whatever. Pitched a complete game. I'm calling it a shutout. It wasn't a shutout. He gave up a run. It was an unearned run. You tell me that there's no such thing as earned and unearned runs in the advanced statistics community. That I'm here to correct. Tell you that advanced statistics have not made their way to 11U baseball. No, the way that they had the order set, we were literally fighting it on the way there. And I was like, you just put the best hitter at the top. I'm like, just give me in order the best hitters. And they were like, well, this person's a perfect leadoff hitter. And I'm like, that doesn't exist. This does not make sense. But
we got to get whatever. The platoons, you know, the lefty righties so that they can't come in with a lefty specialist. You've got a batter.
There's, right? I think there's not a single lefty pitcher.
Well, that's kind of wild. There's not any.
There's one lefty pitcher, but he's not very good. But I think he might have thrown like an inning all year. All of the pitchers who pitch are all righties.
You should have made Baby Fantasy Genius a lefty. Like, his odds of making the major leagues are so much higher as a left-handed pitcher than rather than a right-handed.
Who?
Luca. You should have made him
as a lefty.
Yeah.
Oh no, he's like kind of a killer left-handed pitcher. Also.
Really? I didn't know this. Pat Venditti?
When he plays wiffle ball. Because he can't throw when playing wiffle ball in between baseball. Oh. He pitches lefty, and he's gotten like pretty good left-handed. It's a little annoying to me. Mateo also, with his broken arm, pitches lefty too. It's just like, literally this summer, all of my children are just throwing the ball lefty now.
Just experimenting with it. It's like the summer I decided I wanted to switch hit because Alex Diaz was so valuable doing it. Unfortunately, it turns out that I wasn't good hitting right-handed, so left-handed I wasn't good. Although it's a kind of a more natural swing for me left-handed, I will say.
Anyway, talking about people who've played successful baseball. Complete game shutout in the championship game. A double and a single hitting. He was 2-for-2 with those two. And after the game, so the winning team got a championship belt. Which is like, they get banners all the time if you win these tournaments or whatever. All the kids get rings. But the championship belt is the number one item that you want to win as a program. And they had them sitting out. And I was just like, Luca, you have to win this game. Like, I thought they were going to, but I was like, do not fuck this up. Because this isn't some stupid banner. This isn't like a plaque or a home plate or whatever. This is a championship belt that you're going to have. And you're going to be able to take a photo with that. So... wins that, is for the first time ever tournament MVP. So he has on him, he also got the game ball from the umpire. So he has the ring from the tournament, the game ball, the MVP necklace that you get, and the championship belt all on together. I posted on Instagram and I was like, Luca, Aramis from Enum Claw said that you're iced out. So that's the best part of the whole thing.
That is the best part of it. I don't know if Aramis has a specific number that Luca can wear in his honor.
He was a wrestler. That's where the name Enum Claw comes from.
But you don't have numbers in wrestling, do you?
I don't think so. No, I think you do. You must.
Yeah, I guess you must. All right. Well, we'll look into that further. Anything else on this tournament?
Nope. Two more left for the year. It's kind of sad.
Then we might actually see. I might actually see my nephews again. It'll be fun.
Oh, like you couldn't come? You're blaming that on them, on baseball? As if you cannot drive places in the greater Seattle area?
I'm sorry, where in the greater Seattle area was last weekend's tournament?
Puyallup? You think that far?
Well, there was the weekend before that was Enumclaw, I guess that's, or Enumclaw, Owensburg.
Wait. That was Marco's tournament in Owensburg. Okay. There have been like 15 tournaments in like North Bend, Puyallup, Tacoma, Fife.
These
no
places
Kevin
are not as close to me as you think they are.
It doesn't matter. It's not like it's that far. I like that you're blaming them. As if you don't have a car.
Them.
ESPN's Kevin Pelton can't drive to Fife.
All right, congrats to Jessica Campbell, who will follow Shan Bylsma from Coachella Valley to Seattle and become the first woman to serve as an NHL bench assistant coach. A former member of the Canada national team, Campbell served as a private skating coach before becoming an assistant for the German Nuremberg Ice Tigers and was on the bench with Germany for the 2022 IIHF World Championship prior to joining the Firebirds staff under Bylsma. Longtime NHL assistant Bob Woods will also be on the bench with Bielsma.
There we go.
So a major
milestone. We kind of knew this was coming, but an awesome milestone.
Yeah, not a terrible surprise. I mean, the only question I think was whether Campbell might like become the head coach of Coachella Valley instead. Whether she preferred to stay
a much,
in Coachella
much better
Valley.
Job.
congrats to Nneka Ogwumike, who was selected for her 9th All-Star game on Tuesday as part of Team WNBA that will take on the U.S. Olympic team on July 20th. But
Wait,
an
what?
That's the format this year.
They're going to take on the Olympic team? So it's players who weren't like chosen for the Olympic team.
Correct. So they did this previously in 2021. Like the Olympic team needs to get together and start practicing as soon as they can, because the Olympics start real soon after the end of the WNBA first half of the season, or after the break starts. So they are going to gather in Phoenix for the All-Star game and have some practices and play this game. And then the WNBA All-Star team, led by Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, will take them on July 20th.
Interesting. Do they play this kind of more competitively than like the NBA All-Star game?
Oh yeah, it was super competitive the last time they did this.
I feel like this is actually a good game. The only problem is that Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese are on the same team.
But did Caitlin Clark getting left off the Olympic team playing against the Olympic team?
No, that piece is like having a chance to play them and a little bit of revenge. Like, I mean, basically every single player on Team WNBA probably is at least a little pissed. Or at least the ones who are
eligible. I mean, Nneka Ogwumike is probably still holding a grudge. She is no longer, well, I guess she is still eligible because her change to Nigeria wasn't approved, as we talked about a few weeks back on the podcast, but obviously not in consideration.
But pretty much every single one of the players on Team WNBA is more or less good enough to have played for Team USA.
Correct. I mean, there's just some that are of different nationalities. Jonquel Jones, who is Bahamian, but one player who is not eligible for the U.S. Olympic team will not be there. Anti-congrats to the WNBA coaches who inexplicably did not vote Ezi Magbegor to Team WNBA. You need to be outraged about this.
I'm outraged about this. I just love the idea of an anti-congrats.
it harkens back to, I believe this was...
This is our first ever anti-toast.
JaVale McGee had the anti-shout-out, too. Instead of shouts down to that was
I was shocked though then. I was legitimately shocked when I saw the roster that there was only one Storm player. I didn't and there are no Storm players on Team USA.
No, Joel Lloyd is on the USA team.
Okay, because I was like, there's somebody missing here. When I saw the WNBA All-Star roster, I didn't realize this was the format, but when I saw that roster, I was like, there's something missing right now, and that is more Storm players, because there aren't that many teams in the league, and the Storm are one of the best teams in the league. They need more representation there, and Ezzy should be in this game.
I mean, I don't necessarily think that you should pick players like that, but it is kind of suspicious when three Indiana Fever players made it for a team that is comfortably below 500, and like the fans voted in Caitlin Clark and Aaliyah Boston, but the coaches picked Kelsey Mitchell, who, you know, has been an all-star in the past but has not had a particularly strong start to this season relative to her standards. And Ezzy, I broke this down on ESPN.com in our reaction.
I love this. This is like the first time that you're really writing about WNBA, right?
No, but there's definitely more this year. I had a Caitlin Clark piece earlier this week that that got a lot of attention. Ezzy is on pace for more wins above replacement player by my system than any player in WNBA history who was not selected for an all-star game in a year that the all-star game was played.
Why? Why didn't she make it?
I mean, the group of non-USA players was a little bit stronger in the front court, I would say. I mentioned Jonquel Jones, Brianna Jones was a part of it, DeWanna Bonner, her Connecticut teammate. So you had like a lot of very good players there. But I mean, look, I'm higher on Ezzy than almost anyone, at least outside of the Discord. And we had to vote as part of this process for kind of the starters. You picked the top 10 teams and anyone from that group. It's like in the NBA, it's fan vote, media, and players. And anyone in that group who wasn't on the USA team automatically got put on Team WNBA. So that's how Caitlin Clark and Aaliyah Boston made it in. But we picked, 10 players from everyone in the entire league. And I picked Ezzy for my team.
Wow.
She should be the front runner for Defensive Player of the Year. I mean, she made it last year when the Storm weren't any good. She's playing better this season, and the Storm very good. It just is shocking.
Is she playing better than Nneka Ogwumike also?
I gave her that was kind of where my decision on the final front court spot in that starter group went, and I picked Ezzy, but it was pretty close.
This is shocking information.
I agree it is. I was shocked when I learned
Indiana Fever players, which just is a byproduct of being around Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
Was your story about Caitlin Clark being better than people think, or?
I think there are some ways that she's been better than people think and other ways that she's not been as good. But generally, I think now she's settled into, like, it's not unreasonable for her to be in the All-Star game. She probably should be in the All-Star game at this point, which is about what I expected from her as a rookie, I would say. All right, congrats to UW legend Abdul Gaddy Jr., who is returning to the Huskies as director of player development under Danny Sprinkle after 11 seasons playing professionally. Gaddy retires ninth in G League history in regular season assists, six spots behind Will Conroy, and of course was second on the Husky leaderboard.
It's the most Husky thing of all time to have two players in the top
very
10
much is.
G League assists.
Just really, I mean, I'd be curious to find out between Will Conroy and Abdul Gaddy Jr., what percentage of G League seasons one of the two of them played, because it's pretty much the entire history of the league, I think.
I'm kind of surprised by this news, though. Abdul Gaddy is a name that I had not thought about in a long time.
I mean, he's been in the mix, like he's been in training camps in the NBA, actually basically exclusively with Oklahoma City, for whom's G League team he's largely played, and had played a little overseas as well most recently, but apparently decided it was time to call it quits and begin a coaching career.
But he's the only person who's part of the staff, right?
Correct. He's the only person. No, he's not the only person, but one of the few who wasn't a former assistant coach at Utah, as we'll discuss later.
At Utah State.
No, not Utah State. Utah.
Utah. Okay.
None of the, I mean, Andy Hill is the only member of the staff besides Sprinkle who had coached at Utah State.
That's really funny. I mean, it's he's just such a random player to have been, you know, because obviously there's Will Conroy, there's Quincy Pondexter, players like that. There's certain players that I would have expected to have been part of the program. Abdul Gaddy's a left field one, though.
But it makes sense because he was someone who was here 4 years. He's a point guard, you know, constantly thinking the game. Like, it's a natural transition to coaching, much like it was for Will Conroy.
Okay.
Hasn't been probably as much of a Seattle fixture, I would say, as Conroy was like always very part of the Seattle scene. But I don't know, maybe Abdul Gaddy has been playing in the crossover and I've forgotten about it, which there is no crossover this year. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
Oh, we gotta say, can.
That's what
I'm
I was
not
going to
sure.
say. There's another toast. I was going to say, speaking of Seattle fixtures.
Congrats to Jake One, who got a shot up.
Buckets!
During Friday's Champions of Change
Did he actually
game.
Only play like 2 minutes?
I don't know. I didn't see a box score.
I think I was trying to decipher this from Instagram comments, but I think Jake One might have only played a couple of minutes.
Was Wusang complaining about how little he played?
I think it was him, yes. No, it might have been somebody else. I don't know.
Somebody came to see Jake One and was very disappointed.
But he got like a little like fadeaway jumper. It's a pretty nice shot there.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, we know he can play. All right, congrats to Mariners prospects Harry Ford and Cole Young, who were selected for the All-Star Futures game this year. It's not their fault. You can't blame them. We learned recently that Harry Ford's real name is Harrison Ford, and I had missed this, that he's Harrison Michael Ford, and Mike Ford was Michael Harris is Michael Harrison Ford. Do you know that?
That's no, I had no idea.
So the Mariners had two players with the names Michael Harrison and Ford all together.
I mean, even having two players with the name Harrison Ford is strange.
I agree.
On its own. Okay. Fair enough. Fine. Whatever. Who cares?
But of course, being English, he's a Harry. And lastly, congrats to new UW gymnastics coach Jessa Hansen Parker. Parker, previously an assistant at Iowa, replaces former UW coach Jen Llewellyn, who left to become the head coach at Iowa. So a little big inter Big Ten carousel there. Okay, we can talk NBA now.
Yeah, let's talk NBA. So you flew to Bristol and New York this last week to be part of the draft. I guess how was that experience? You know, you've done this is your second year in a row being part of the YouTube live stream that they've had alongside the ESPN broadcast.
Correct, yeah. The Hoop Collective live stream. So Brian Windhorst there and King McClure has been part of the crew both years. Had a different host this year with Amina Smith stepping into that role.
I feel like so last year you kind of you went in and out, right? It was what's his name who does the shot charts who is there with you, right?
Kirk Goldsberry and then Trey
Yeah,
Murphy
Kirk
the
Goldsberry.
third was part of the broadcast last year. Friend of the
Okay.
pod, Trey Murphy the third.
So they let you cook here a little bit. They gave you a little bit more time on ice in this particular broadcast. Obviously sharing numbers on the board as well. What was your experience being there and breaking down a mostly boring draft?
I know. I mean, I was talking about it with our mom, and I was like, kind of not that much happened. There weren't really many trades, which was a good thing for me because I didn't have to, like, there was scenarios where if a big enough trade happened, it was down to three people, and I was just going to have to go write some trade grades. King joked beforehand how much he enjoyed reading my trade grades, and I was like, well, you might see them in real time this year.
So you would
So.
have had to have like you would have just left the broadcast and gone to go write trade grades.
If there was a big enough trade, yeah.
An NBA player. I loved my favorite part. So I was literally flying, like I was taxiing while I was watching this. So I saw the fir I saw up until the moment Portland drafted Donovan Clingan, or like right when they were about to draft Donovan Clingan. And my favorite part of the broadcast was you getting off your point that Houston had drafted more along your particular projections than any other team. And then they made the pick alongside your projections as it was happening, a fact that you heard here first on the Pelton cast.
I mean, I think I previously had written it in my draft projections, but pretty
First.
close.
I said heard, not read.
That's fair. Fair. Or you just point out that Brian Windhorst subsequently made fun of me for bragging when I said that?
I felt the same thing. No, I would love that you got that point off that you, because it wasn't exactly bragging per se. The only bragging
No.
part about it is noting that the players have turned out good. Because if they would have all been bad, you'd be like, yeah, they drafted Michael Sweetney when I really wanted him.
Wow, that's a deep cut. It's been a minute. That was somebody I definitely desperately wanted for the Sonics back in the day. I guess Nick Collison turned out fine. I think most people on Discord's favorite moment was the gifable moment of me aggressively shaking my head
What were you
about.
shaking your head about
I
there?
can't even remember it. It's in the larger clip. It was basically like, some discussion of like. They weren't asking him to create shots, King was saying. I was like, no, absolutely not. But it's a terrific gif that describes everyone's feelings about the Mariners right now.
Do you ever, like, when you're on there on the live broadcast, want to get into hot takes territory? I feel like Wendy is more willing to do it, but people don't get that. People get more of that part of your personality here on the Pelton cast.
They do. I mean, it's that live stream is probably a little less aggregatable than a usual podcast, but it's still more dangerous.
Of getting off any hot takes. Well, okay. Do you have any hot takes post draft now about the draft?
Not really. I mean, it's interesting because the person I was the lowest on, relatively, just in being Dalton Connect, just went pretty low. And then I liked the fit. He went about where I thought he should and to a team where he fits well.
You kept
So.
liking the picks. Like they were like the I still forget this dude's name, whoever Chicago drafted. And they were like, wow, that seems like a real reach per your stats. And you're like, no, I like him. You're like, yeah, it's a good fit.
I mean, well, part of it is like obviously I'm allowed to consider things besides my projections. So I'm naturally going to shade my projections a little bit towards the consensus. I mean, the funny thing is like Zach Edey went, closer to where my projections had him than where I actually thought he should have gone.
You thought he should have gone lower?
Yeah, I thought he should was in kind of the late teens on my subjective board. So Ron Holland was maybe the biggest difference where I had him like fourth or fifth on my subjective list, just because I do think his skill set makes sense, even though he was like 20 something in my projections.
He was the biggest difference between projections and subjective.
Probably. Matas Buzelis, who the Bulls drafted, then subsequently, I think I told you this, he was on my flight to Chicago on Friday night. So he is very tall, as it turns out.
There you go. First class?
Yes.
Okay. Name dropping again.
I wasn't there. I was a ghost.
No, no, you're name dropping your brush with fame with Matas Buzelis. Okay, we also had free agency start during this last time period. And no talking taco time episodes.
Zero.
What is your takeaway? I feel like it's been a mostly uninteresting free agency. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, Paul George did change teams. That's a pretty massive move.
Okay,
no all-star enough. Had current all-star had changed teams via free agency since 2019.
Who is that?
Oh, a bunch did that year. Durant, Kyrie Irving, Katie. Kawhi yeah. Leonard.
Oh, that was that year.
Yeah. There's probably some others I'm missing.
Which teams do you feel like have changed their, like, if you had to grade any teams for this offseason, are there any teams that you feel like have changed their fortunes significantly so far, positive or negative?
Yeah, I mean, the New York Knicks, like, not getting Isaiah Harten and losing Isaiah Hartenstein is a disappointment, but getting Mikal Bridges is still a huge move for them. I mean, I think there's a lot of teams that sort of, it does feel like some of the top teams have separated themselves by getting better. New York, Oklahoma City has improved more than anyone with Alex Caruso and Isaiah Hartenstein. And then, I mean, Philly, I still have questions about exactly how much depth they're going to have. But again, they got Paul George, who's like the perfect third player to play with Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey.
It's kind of an arms race in the East, especially. Although in the West, I suppose there's kind of like four teams that are all in the same territory. It just feels like Minnesota did. I mean, Dallas might have gotten better. I'm not even sure if they're part of that. But like Minnesota didn't do anything to get better, right? They're just hoping that Anthony Edwards improves.
I mean, they did get the number 8 pick in the draft.
Who is that?
Rob Dillingham.
Okay. But like, you're probably not expecting the number 8 pick in the draft to be that much a contributor in year one.
Probably not. And in free agency, they're going to be losing players rather than adding them. They replaced Kyle Anderson with Joe Ingles. I like that for them.
But this Hartenstein move, you think pushes Oklahoma City to the number 1 team in the West?
Well, they were already the number 1 team in the West in my mind.
Okay.
And Caruso
pushes them even further. Are they Caruso's in Celtics territory?
It's plausible. Yeah.
But if you were projecting for next year, the Celtics are still the favorite for the champions.
I'll pick the Celtics, barring something unforeseen between here and October. It'd be right. Celtics over Thunder.
Okay, last piece of NBA news, which is NBA to Seattle news. Is there anything to be made from everything that you know and have heard about the Boston Celtics, who a minority owner is also part of the Kraken ownership group, the Boston Celtics being put for sale?
Like, do I think that relates to expansion?
Yes.
No. I mean,
okay.
The price for the Celtics could influence what the eventual expansion fee is. And I think it probably is good news for David Bonderman from a financial standpoint, because if he was just selling his whatever percentage of the Celtics in order to become a larger owner of the Sonics, like, you'd have to sell at a really big discount. If you can sell that as part of selling the entire team to someone who is actually getting majority, you know, the controlling stake, it becomes a lot more valuable that way.
Yes. What is the dollar amount for the Celtics? Like, if you had a guess.
I mean, it might not be quite as high as you think, just because they don't have a great arena situation. The Bruins own and operate TD Garden, and the Celtics are merely tenants there, which down the road, I think there's a very real possible that they could try to build their own arena. Is
wow,
whoever this new ownership
in the Garden. Wait, why do the Bruins own and operate? Is that a thing that's from the 60s?
Yes. when the Bruins were the number one team in town, even though the Celtics were launching the most unparalleled dynasty in U.S. pro sports history.
That's kind of wild. Okay, so if you're
if
David
only
Bonham,
I could think of some difference between the Celtics and Bruins that might explain why one was more beloved in Boston than the other.
But this is like way, way back.
That's things last generations.
But okay, let's say you're David Bonnerman. That's the situation that you're dealing with. Obviously, he's a part owner of the Kraken as well, right?
He's the majority owner of the Kraken.
That maybe isn't, I guess if you own both teams, you're more fine with that. Rather
yes,
than
it's definitely preferable. But look, the Kraken want ownership group. Bonnerman, they want to buy it. They want to own the NBA team. They want to own the Sonics for obvious
yes.
reasons. Guess what? They're not the only billionaires out there who are probably going to be interested in owning an NBA team in Seattle.
Do you think the NBA would be incentivized? Like, they don't really care if it's the same group, right?
I mean, it is helpful from a scheduling standpoint, that sort of thing.
If you have both. Okay. But you don't think that these moves are connected in any way? Okay.
Absolutely not. No.
Why is
give me,
the
give me
Celtics
the
owner...
shaking no, because the Celtics are about to become the most expensive team ever. And you're also selling high because it can't possibly get better than this.
You're just like, fuck it. We just won a championship. Let's go make some money.
What Grosbeck is like the, so he's trying to sell it on the Glenn Taylor plan where you like buy it in installments and he gets to keep running the team until, you know, this deal is actually complete is his hope in 2028, according to the press release they issued. So it's like, okay, I'm going to still run the team while we're potentially winning all the championships, but you're going to pay part of the luxury tax bill that we're incurring for those. And then when the team probably has to sell off or it maybe starts to age out of this, then I'm going to peace out with all the money and you can have the team.
So that will change the price, though. I mean, that's different than somebody coming in and buying the team today.
Probably, yes.
Where it would be, like, what is the number? 5 billion? 6 billion?
I think that's a floor.
Okay. But it is a little bit different than just being like, the team is yours today. If they're trying to operate the team for a few years, it's a less desirable situation for somebody.
Correct.
Okay.
All right.
I guess you could have just left that at a no. Are these things connected? No.
People have been asking, so it's good that we go through it, I suppose.
You didn't have it in the notes, at the very least.
Well, what I
You're
do
like,
have in the notes.
Can we get to the roundup?
What I do have in the notes is my search for New York's best cookie.
Hello.
At Levin Bakery, which we've already talked about when you went there. When were you in New York?
April.
Okay. So obviously I had to hit it during my very brief stints in New York before on the either side of being in Bristol. A little on Levin, because I don't think I did this research before we talked about them the last time. Baking hobbyists Pam Weeks and Connie McDonald started Levin to sell fresh-baked breads. In 1995, they whipped up a batch of big chocolate chip walnut cookies, and their neighborhood shop became so much more. The cookie earned a spot in the hearts of locals and visitors alike. Like taking on a life of its own as a New York City icon, nearly 30 years later, not much has changed. We're still baking beloved cookies with simple ingredients and a lot of love.
Did Met Market rip off this cookie?
I think they very clearly indicated they did. Didn't we learn that in the Met Market story?
Okay. Well, that just disqualifies it completely.
I don't know if I would say that necessarily. I think it's more
okay.
the... Yeah. I guess it doesn't specifically say on this that it's Levin.
But it's like a chocolate chip walnut cookie, and they literally call it the cookie.
It's true. Theirs is a little different. The Met Market, the cookie, is not nearly as volcanic as Levin's.
Okay. What was your experience at Levin?
So I got the chocolate chip, and then I got the seasonal lemon. Was that the seasonal that you were talking about trying to get?
I think so, that I did not get.
Right, where it has
yeah.
lemon chips. Like white chocolate chips with a lemon flavor and then lemon. I enjoyed it quite a bit, but
that honestly sounds great.
The chocolate chip, what I liked about it was it nailed that sweet spot of being crunchy on the outside and gooey on the inside, which I'd say is a little different again from the cookie, which is just straight gooey.
All gooey. Yeah.
There's not
100% goo.
And is served hot. These aren't necessarily served hot. That isn't part of their appeal, but I mean, it's up there with any cookie in Seattle without question. Like, this
Was there
lives
a
up to
line
the
when you went?
hype. Nah, there was like a couple people there. There was one guy who was like trying to place some sort of group order, and I was very annoyed about that they were slowing things down. But I made it there and back in time to write about whatever trade it was that happened Friday morning.
I like that you're still distracted right now. Is it because you're checking NBA news?
Oh no, I'm sending texts about the player that UW signed that we'll talk about later in the pod, or didn't, I guess.
Oh, you're
Committed to
doing
UW.
real-time research.
I am doing real-time research.
Wow. Okay.
It involves texting with people in France. So I didn't have the opportunity to do it earlier.
There we go. I like to see that you're committed to this podcast.
I am committed to it on once we get far enough on either side of NBA free agency.
I literally thought you were there checking like some player. You're just like,
No, nothing is happening right now.
I mean, Paul George news breaks at like midnight. I would be shocked.
That's true, but that was still the first night of free agency. Oh, it's a little too quiet right now, just like I thought when nothing happened on the day before the draft until at 10 p.m. And I did I tell you this story?
No.
So I was at the Brooklyn Nets game in Long Island at UBS Arena against not the Brooklyn Nets, the New York Liberty game
I
against the
was like,
Minnesota
what are you
Lynx.
talking? When did this happen?
The Liberty and Brooklyn Nets are owned by the same people, primarily Joe Tsai, who's sitting courtside, like on the same end as the media section. So we could see everything he did the entire game. I didn't notice this, but Tim Bontemps, who was with me, did. At some point during the second half, he left to go take a phone call. And then with like 2 minutes left in the game, the Mikal Bridges trade drops.
Wow. So you literally saw Joe Tsai like approve the trade in
Not
real
me,
time.
but I could have, yes.
That's kind of incredible.
Yeah. So it's a little too quiet, much like at that point, I guess is what I'm saying. So
So
I hope
you're nervous. You're on high alert.
I'm very nervous about my 4th of July. Especially because there's a lot of driving involved. All right. But with that, is it time for your least favorite segment?
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Honestly, this is one of the other things I want to talk about, but I was going to not even do Mariners hot takes. I was going to instead talk about how we know the Mariners are bad, ha ha ha, and most importantly, get into the official death of the Pac-12. But instead, I have to talk about another death, and that is not the Mariners 2024 season. It's the Mariners front office, ownership, and franchise in general. I've seen people say, wow, the Mariners franchise sure is cursed. Everything goes wrong for them. And that is not something I believe in. No franchise is cursed. Instead, in this sport, which has an uneven balance of front office skill and payroll, the only curse you can have is bad leadership and bad ownership. The last two off seasons, since making the playoffs, one time in 20 years, they have approached each from the perspective not of improving the team overall, short or long term, but rather improving profit margins for ownership. They recognized they had an excited fan base and increased ticket prices significantly without spending on the field. They prioritized signing older players to short, cheaper contracts. They also focused on the wrong places overall as an organization. They have spent time, energy, and resources around pitching, which is notably inconsistent and unreliable year to year, without the thought of flipping those players for young offensive talent. Instead, trying to papier-mâché together a roster of players who were good in 2020, literally just hoping for something good to happen. That's been the plan. And that is why, under John Stanton, this Mariners team will never win a World Series because they simply do not care about winning as much as other organizations. From top to bottom, the number one priority is ownership profits, saving money. They just don't give a fuck, and it's apparent. They want to win enough to make sure they can continue to charge their exorbitant ticket prices. wow people with drone shows and score one fucking run in the game. So John Stanton, do the city of Seattle a favor and put the Mariners for sale. There's no shortage of billionaires out there and in the city of Seattle who want to compete with their billionaire friends on the field. Take the hundreds of millions of dollars of profits and walk the fuck away. Because this 4th of July, we want to also see some fireworks on the field, not just after the game. I truly hate this team. I hate every single part about them. Literally, not no holes, only holes.
You know, you have only you yourself to blame for having expectations.
There's literally not a good part of the team. That's it. There's nothing good. I was thinking about this. Mrs. Fantasy Genius was like, be nice to Julio. And I was like, sometimes when you're a good player, you have to also play good. When you look around the MLB, I'm like, is Gunnar Henderson hitting 247? Is Adley Rutschman hitting 247? Bobby Witt, Ronald Acuna before he got hurt? Shohei, Mookie Betts? All of these players are who we thought were Julio Rodriguez's peers, but we were wrong. He is not peers with those types of players. Those players are in an echelon of their own, and they're still playing well right now, and their teams are winning games. And then I looked at the teams. Also, my favorite part about this is the massive disconnect that the Mariners broadcast has of who is going to be the all-star starter versus the world, real world. They were like, this might be Logan Gilbert's battery mate with Adley Rutschman starting the All-Star game. And I was like, dog, is that true? And then I looked it up, and there's no chance that Logan Gilbert starts the All-Star game. I was like, this is literally just something that they have made up in their minds. It's one of those things where you're like, I guess that could happen if many other players get injured, but there's a reality that it's just not going to happen. They're going to have one All-Star, maybe two, obviously no offensive all-stars. And when I looked around at the league, I was looking at the top pitchers by war. And there honestly are so many good pitchers by war who are on truly awful teams. The White Sox have two of them in the top 10. And have you ever heard of those players? Absolutely not. And neither have I.
I've heard of Crochet because he shut down the Mariners. And then
there we go.
The Rangers came to town and it was the Fox game and they had a mic'd up conversation. I forget who it was, but someone was talking with Ty France at first base about how hard it was to hit Crochet from the Rangers.
Right. It's like, literally, I mean, we saw it with Felix. You can have some of the best pitchers in baseball and still be an extraordinarily bad team. It can happen a little bit with hitters, but if you look at the top 10 hitters by offensive war, basically every single one of them in the AL has a bet. Their teams have a better record than the Mariners. It just doesn't happen as much. Pitching is not as important as hitting, period. Matter of fact, done. And the Mariners have a whole glut of pitching.
I mean, an individual pitcher is not as important as hitter. I mean, I do think pitching is less important, overall, but those are not the same
thing. An
individual
hitter is the value of an individual. Any individual pitcher.
Well, yeah, you know who else knows that? The other teams I understand would be trading with the Mariners. This like, well, why don't they just, you know, pull the wool over someone's eyes? Like, I don't know. It's not easy to do.
But it's just like, we can't just sit back and say Jerry DePoto has assembled a good roster because they have good pitching. It's like they have the thing that is much easier to have overall.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's easier to have.
It is definitely easier to have good pitching than to have good elite hitting.
I mean, first off, it's by definition, they're both relative. So it can't be easier to have one than the other because, like, what defines elite pitching and what defines elite hitting is defined by the number of elite pitchers or elite hitters there are.
It's also just more important to have. I don't know if I agree with that. Elite hitting costs more and it's harder to obtain. Like, what are you talking about?
But how can it be harder to obtain? The same pile of resources goes into both of them.
That's not true. A lot more money goes to hitters. It's not the same pile of resources. You have to spend a lot more in terms of resources, in terms of prospects to trade for players, and money to acquire players. What are you talking about? It's not like it's like split evenly. If you ever, that's like saying like, offense and defense in the NFL is the exact same.
But like
you spent a hell of a lot more on quarterbacks.
Offense in baseball and the odds of being the best pitching staff in baseball, like they're the same because there's only one of each of them. How can this not make sense to you?
But you could be the best pitching staff in baseball and it's not as important as being the best hitting in baseball.
Okay, I don't think the Mariners are just sitting there saying, we don't care about hitting. No, no interest in hitting here,
sir. It's not that they don't care about hitting. It's that they're bad at it. And they're bad at finding hitters. They have... They tried this offseason. Like the fact
I just
that
don't
Jorge
believe
Blanco,
that actually. No, I think it's fucking bullshit, honestly. Like,
what are you talking about?
People
no,
are like,
not,
oh, John Schneider
bullshit.
Is good at drafting this position, but not at this position. No, it's just small sample size.
It's not small sample size.
And also,
how
it's the fucking ballpark that ruins every hitter who comes here. Adrian Beltre died for I don't know who's since, but
well, you play
like, this
half
has been
the
going
games
on for 25 years here now.
You play. They have had good hitters.
It
at various
breaks
times.
The brains of hitters. I don't. There's no other logical explanation for why every hitter who comes here instantly gets worse, and then they leave.
Maybe.
And they often get better.
Who? Gino
Jared
Suarez
Kelnick,
didn't get better.
Teoscar Hernandez.
Look at this. Teoscar
is playing well.
Is he playing well? Well,
yeah,
good.
He had a very strong
fucking,
June.
Great. It's a player that the Mariners traded away for.
But
absolutely
it never
would have
happened
nothing.
Here.
That's not true. He was 24. How
never
can you say it
wouldn't
have
here.
Happened here? That's bullshit. He was in the early 2000s. You look at those Mariners stats and you're like, these are all amazing stats. Why did
I
he just start with Adrian Beltre? They just haven't had good players.
I don't know why it somehow was different in the early 2000s. But
the
again,
fences were further in the early 2000s.
I'm aware.
And they still had really good hitters. There's a reality that they just haven't had any good hitters in that time period somehow. But like Nelson
again,
Cruz,
I'm telling
Nelson
you, they had
Cruz
Adrian
was
Beltre.
Pretty good
he's
here.
A Hall
Robinson
of Famer.
Cano was pretty good here. It's just Adrian Beltre. You're talking about small sample size, and your sample size is literally just Adrian Beltre.
I think there's a lot more than Adrian Beltre. But
there is a cliff that hitters go off of at a certain point, and it's like you have certainly hitters that can make it past this point.
But
looking,
that's true, then you would
Jorge
be able
Polanco,
to predict it statistically. Again, it's all of these things like, yeah, it's obvious after something has happened that it's going to happen. The trick is predicting it before it happens. That's what the job is.
The trick is going and getting good young baseball players.
Okay,
that's
well,
it.
What?
Like, you have to spend for it. You have to spend to get
the
hard the
Mariners should spend more
money and resources, and they haven't done it. And they're just like, I mean, Julio has obviously been worse than anybody expected through this point, but like the rest of the roster, they've been worse. The hitters have been worse on this team, but they haven't been that much worse.
I think they probably have been that much worse. I haven't looked at it. I mean, that's what's perplexing is like they're still striking out more than any team in baseball by a wide margin, and you can't blame Brant Brown anymore. Like he's gone. Maybe he screwed everyone's heads up in spring training irreparably.
They scapegoated Brant Brown and then they played the fucking White Sox and they were like, mission accomplished.
I mean,
they played horrible teams.
Mission wasn't accomplished against the White Sox. I don't know if you recall, the hitting was not great in that series.
No, it was like only in the ninth inning on. But they really were like, they played the A's and the White Sox and they're like, fucking Brant Brown ruined us. And then they played a real team and all of a sudden Brant Brown sent back like, yeah, maybe you just signed bad players. When you're looking for players that are willing to sign cheap-ish 1-2 year deals, they're not going to be as good as the players that are looking for bigger deals.
I mean, I suppose so. But again, like Mitch Garver did a certain thing last year, and you projected a certain thing based on what Mitch Garver did last year, and then Mitch Garver did not do the same thing.
What did they trade for Mitch Garver, or they signed him?
They signed him as a free agent on Christmas Eve.
What was the deal that Mitch Garver got?
I don't know. It's probably like 2 years, $18 million.
He's also 33 years old. Your same logic that you're telling me about the Mariners trading for pitchers, and it's like the rest of the team knows this info also. Well, the rest of the league knows.
Well, they didn't sign Mitch Garver for the veterans minimum. This isn't Tommy La Stella we're talking about.
But it's
he signed a 3 year
for $10.5 million. It's not like I don't know what a mutual option means. With the buyout, I think that's a team option.
I meant $35 million, not $45 million.
If you're willing to sign a 2 year deal, $10.5 million, $12.5 million with the team option after that, you don't have the same options that other players in the market do. It
I
is
suppose
a lot
so.
Cheaper.
Mitch Garver signed a much smaller contract than that with the Rangers. I mean, I guess he was still on arbitration, and he played well for them.
They were hoping to get lucky with Mitch Garver.
I mean, look, obviously, again, if the Mariners should spend more money, it would be better for their chances if they spend more money. There's still all the examples of all the teams that spend a lot of money who aren't the Dodgers and it not and the Yankees this year, who it not translated.
You have to try. I mean, two seasons ago, Mitch Garver was at a 702 OPS. He's at 647 right now. And like, Mitch Garver is not exactly the problem. If Mitch Garver was doing what he was doing, but other players were playing well, Mitch, it would be fine. But it's that everybody is doing that.
I just agree that that's the problem. And I just don't, there's no projection system out there that said every player on the team is going to get this much worse. Jorge Polanco is going to go completely to zero.
I don't think you can just blame the ballpark, though.
Like what
that
else
should affect
is it?
Home runs, but like beyond that, there's a whole other part of the field
again,
that you can hit the ball to
again,
outside of hitting out of the field.
Like, we have all these projection tools to project players. If all the projection tools say the players are going to be better than they are, then it's either you are cursed or there's some sort of explanation that was not foreseeable beforehand. It can't be that the Mariners guessed wrong on every single player, including their own incumbent players, who all of them are hitting worse.
The Julio thing, but like, did the ballpark change, like from last year to this year? What?
I don't know. Maybe it is the Brant Brown irreparably ruined everything.
I am unwilling to scapegoat Brant Brown for this. I do not buy that Brant
like
Brown
has
that much ability.
Their entire focus in the offseason was striking out less, and they're striking out maybe the most in baseball history.
They really do
make
strike
any logical
out all
sense.
The time. They strike out so often. It is like, literally,
it is
so
the definition
much time
of irony.
Watching this team play baseball, and I enjoyed it, and I'm still doing it before. And now I hate every single second of it. The Orioles scored two runs. Also, just like every single ball that gets hit against the Mariners happens to go to an open space on the field. Like they weren't, some of them, a couple of them today were hard. Like the Santander ball was a hard hit ball, but a lot of them
the
were just
rally
like
against Kirby on Monday, on Tuesday night. It was
just like
so many
singles. You're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So the Mariners still lead the AL West by two games.
It's such a, I mean, whatever. Two games.
They are down to a plus one run differential, which ranks eighth in the AL. But their Fangraph playoff odds are still sitting at 63%, 52% to win the division. And even though their wild cards odds are not very good, because basically if they do poorly enough that the Astros catch them, other teams will probably be ahead of them.
But
they are
even
favored to win more games than the other teams in the third wild card mix.
If they fell below the Astros, they wouldn't be in the wild card right now, though. Like, let's say that.
But I'm saying is that the Fangraphs projections say that they are projected ahead of those teams as well as the Astros.
I'm gonna trust Fangraphs on this, because Fangraphs is usually right about this shit. Like, the Astros kept playing badly, and I was like, what are you talking about, Fangraphs? And then all of a sudden the Astros got good, and I was like, damn, there are not glitches in the computer.
11-2 over this stretch, where the Mariners have gone 10-3.
Not 10-3.
3-2. Yes.
I would like to go out of my way to note that the Mariners have not gone 10-3.
Mariners opponents have gone 10-3 during this particular stretch. Maybe it is some sort of a curse involving the Sounders.
It's not. There's not a curse. I'm telling you, that is the thing that I hate. It's a fucking, like.
But why were the Sounders bad the year that the Mariners were good?
You can't. This is so stupid. You're like, it's small sample size, but it has to do with the hockey or the soccer team. Like,
it's uncanny the way it worked out.
How many even great prospects? I mean, Kelenic was worse than he should have been, but like, it's not like there's been a massive influx of talent in Seattle baseball, and all of it for some reason was bad, or they spent so much money on players and they played badly. Robinson Cano more or less played well. They spent on one free agent ever, who more or less played well, right? Like, we're talking about, what is the dude's name? Fernando Vina or whatever? Like, that's their biggest free agent signing before this year. Like,
Fernando Vina?
Who's the player? It's some, like, hilarious player like that.
I believe it was a Japanese outfielder.
Oh, Nori Aoki. But it's like, it's not like they've spent on big name players. It's not like Shohei came here and then all of a sudden sucked.
I think you're underestimating the degree to which the hitters that they've acquired via trade have been relatively proven hitters. Teoscar Hernandez, of course.
Teoscar wasn't bad last year. He's gotten better, but it's not like he was bad.
I think he was doing similar things to that are frustrating about this year's team. Let's put it that way. The things that were frustrating about Teoscar Hernandez.
He had 26 home runs and a 741 OPS.
Yes,
like
that would be substantially better than this. But
like,
again,
his
OPS
slowly.
Goes 807, 741, 796. There's one of these seasons is not like the others.
But that is also kind of how baseball works. Like, you don't just have Teoscar Hernandez for 1 year.
The way baseball works is that half of those things go right and half of those things go wrong. Not all of the things go wrong.
I think if they had kept Teoscar, he probably would be doing the same thing here. I mean, there's also a reality that it probably matters, the players who are around you. And if you don't have good hitters around...
No, like, I think all the evidence suggests that it does not matter even...
You don't think that people have to pitch to Teoscar more because of having Shohei in the lineup as well?
I mean, maybe there's updated sabermetrics research from my state-of-the-art 2005 era knowledge. But I think the evidence was pretty strong back then that the batting order effect is not real. That hitters pretty much are who they are. And ballpark effects are real.
I mean, he was worth 2 wins last year. Like, the Mariners, for any free agent signing, would be thrilled with a player who was on pace for 2 wins this season.
And I think they should have offered him the qualifying offer. I think that was a pretty big mistake not to. You know, Jesse Winker has 1.7 WAR this season.
Wow. Bring back Winker.
But he wouldn't work here.
There aren't even good vibes.
Do you know what his OPS was? He went from 949 in Cincinnati. He'd been over 900 2 years in a row to 688 with the Mariners. His slugging percentage went from 556 to 344.
He signed a minor league deal on this. Do you think that the Mariners screwed him up for multiple years?
I don't know what happened last year in Milwaukee.
How many years was Brant Brown his hitting coach? Following Jesse Winker around for a couple years and then stopped.
Maybe Brant Brown is flashing a laser in the eyes of the hitters to distract them.
The curse that people are talking about. Jesse Winker was worse in Milwaukee last year than he was in Seattle.
He was worse in Milwaukee. It's true.
That's what I'm saying. There's a little bit of an element of baseball goes up and down. But they didn't. Teoscar Hernandez got paid $23.5 million for the season.
No.
Would the Mariners have spent that? Absolutely not.
No. But baseball, again, it doesn't go up and down in Seattle. It just goes down. At least hitting wise.
Luke Rayleigh's playing pretty well, isn't he?
He is, yes. He might be the best hitter on the team, Luke Rayleigh.
At least that's all we've got.
They can't take Luke Rayleigh from us.
Breakfast at Tiffany's. His OPS did go way down, but I think last year was a bit of a fluke.
Yes, I think that Luke Rayleigh is probably still beating his projections.
Anyway, I hate everything about this baseball team. I'll keep watching.
I don't know that I will.
It's especially frustrating playing the Orioles, who have gone very all in, and they have to be one of the odds on favorites to win the World Series this year.
Except they haven't gone very all in because they're spending less money than the Mariners.
I mean, they also appropriately tanked for longer. Yeah.
And got higher draft picks. Frankly, the Mariners got too good too fast was their biggest problem. Well, maybe a problem for the Seattle Kraken, who have had a busy, it's been a week for the Kraken.
They also made a massive trade for, like, Cy Young pitcher. Like, I just wouldn't.
Sure. They made, well, I don't know why they invested in a pitcher. What a waste of money.
Because they already had the hitting. That's the reality. We've talked about this. When you The Mariners have to go in at some point this year. Like they can either fuck off this year and they will never be good again, or they have to try right
I think
now.
They should definitely sit out this year at this point. I mean, I guess maybe if it's the
what
AL
is the
West
plan,
with that
then?
Opportunity.
What is the plan if they sit out this year? At
Hope
some
that
point,
Julio
you
Rodriguez
have
is
to try to
actually
win games.
Plays to
But,
the level
okay,
that he did last season again.
If you're going to tell us that Julio is a great second half player, which let me tell you,
I'm not saying no. I'm not saying
very
in,
confident in that.
I mean, first off, have you never watched a local broadcast before? Is this your first time?
I just literally, like, I was laying on the couch and they were like, wow, this might be the battery made of the All-Star game. And I was like, will it? And then I had to look it up and I was like, no chance.
I mean, first off, I wouldn't look at war. Like, I'd look at wins first on that one.
I looked at wins. I looked at war. I looked at a projection of who it's going to be. Literally, Logan Gilbert, he's on the All-Star roster. It was like a thing from like some website. And it was like, Logan Gilbert will be an All-Star, but there was not like there's a chance that he's the All-Star starter.
Well, in front of home fans.
A Mariner? I disagree with you, however. We talked about this 2 weeks ago. If they can go
No,
in
the point is that you wait for next year for Julio Rodriguez to get back to normal.
But then, how about this? If you have Luis Robert or Vlad Guerrero, you could maybe be good this year.
But they're just
going to
come
year,
here and be bad. That's just
that. No, that can't be the solution. Just saying nothing matters. No, like,
I mean,
literally, let's not try to have good. I would
believe
Pelgast
nihilism is the
just
answer.
Wait for the Mariners to pick up on this and start pitching people. Already, they told us we were a small market. And they're doing us a favor by not trying to win that much right now. But wait for the Mariners to be like, all hitters suck when they come here. The Jerry DePoto interview, where he's like, you know what? The hitters are just going to suck anyway. So that's why we're not trying to have.
I mean, I actually think to go back to the 2001 thing, the solution is to stop trying to have any power hitting. Like the Mariners, the one thing they do well is power hitting. And it's probably the skill that plays worst at T-Mobile Park. It's a whole team. It needs to be a whole team of, you know what?
Of Ichiros? Because
yes,
let me tell
that's
you.
That's when it worked.
Brett Boone sure had some power in 2001.
I suppose so, but it was a lot of like Stan Javier and Mark McLemore.
I would love for you
John
to
Olerud
revisit,
hitting doubles.
Oh, I would love for you to revisit the 2001 Mariners because I think your perspective of them does not match up with reality. Let me just pull up here. Okay,
I mean, I'm sure Brett Boone had 37
home runs from Boone, 25 from Mike Cameron, 23 from Edgar. OPS 873 from John Oliver, 950 for Boone, 966 for Edgar.
We're not talking about OPS here. We're talking about isolated slugging.
Like, this team freaking hit.
My argument was not that they didn't hit. My argument was that they hit for average, which they had an average 10 points higher than anyone in baseball. Their slugging percentage was only fourth in the AL. Their OBP was number one. But in homer, like, I don't have this as a rate stat, but in home runs, they were slightly lower than the average. You're forgetting that this is an era where the ball was juiced and everyone was on steroids.
I do miss those eras.
I
that
mean,
era.
Like, the pitch clock is cool and all, but bring that back.
Bring back the juice ball.
Yes.
I agree. Anyway, my argument is that
the Mariners home run rate in 2001 ranked 30, 29, 28, 27, 26, 25, 24, 23rd out of 30 teams.
All right, fine. Great.
So stop trying to hit home runs. That's the only solution.
But I feel like these players, it's not like they were like slap singles hitters, is what I'm saying. Like Boone,
I mean, I'm not
Olerud
actually saying they
Edgar.
All need to be Ichiro, but John Olerud is like one of the most noted lack of power great first baseman ever. Like relative to his skill, his value, more of that was in his batting average and his on base percentage than almost any first baseman in history.
I guess so. I mean,
in
what
modern
do you mean
history?
Any first baseman in history? I've seen Ty France; he's in history.
But
255 homers, like.
But again, the point isn't that these guys couldn't hit for power. The point is that their primary skill was putting the ball in play repeatedly. You know,
okay,
John Olerud
do that.
363 in a season, right?
No, I'm not saying John Olerud was bad. John Olerud was
Why
great.
Why didn't the Mariners draft Stephen Kwan is the question I'm again asking.
Where did Stephen Kwan get drafted?
In the fifth round. Pretty sure. I looked this up when he came through town.
I mean, you could probably pick any player.
Obviously, the baseball draft is very uncertain, but I'm
I mean,
just
you could just be
saying.
like, why did the Mariners draft Mike Trout? I'm like, yeah, I don't.
Well, you can't be like, why didn't they draft Gunnar Henderson, right? Or someone like
Sure.
that. Adley Rutschman, why didn't they just draft him? Oh, Gunnar Henderson was in the second round, so I guess they could have drafted him.
Oh, there's your tanking point right there.
But he was probably picked with a high pick in the second round, I bet.
Well, I bet the Mariners had a pick in the first round.
Yeah, he was the top pick in the second round. The Mariners didn't tank hard enough. That's the fact. A fact.
That you can't. Who did the Mariners draft? What year was this?
But again, it's not individual draft picks. It's just having a higher draft pick is better than having a lower draft pick. Like, you can't dispute that.
I mean, I guess so. Wait, what? Who did the Mariners draft this year? Oh, George Kirby. Honestly, pretty good draft pick that year. Not
Yeah.
gonna lie. But the Orioles getting Adley Rutschman and Gunnar Henderson in the same draft is like, I mean, just pick 42. Did the Mariners have a comp pick that year? No. Oh, Volpe was part of that draft also. The Mariner and Corbin Carroll. That's like the Seahawks getting Bobby Wagner and Russell Wilson in the same draft.
And Bruce Irvin. All right, again, Seattle Kraken. A lot going on in the past week. They pretty much condensed the entire offseason into the past week. We mentioned the Jessica Campbell news that came after Coachella Valley lost the Calder Cup Finals 4-2 to the Hershey Bears, ending the run for Bylsma and Campbell with the Firebirds before taking over the Kraken. Starting last Friday was the NHL draft, where the Kraken managed to save on scouting this year by taking a pair of players with their top two picks who played in the state of Washington
There
in
we
the
go.
WHL. They took Spokane Chiefs center Berkeley Catton with the number 8 pick and Everett Silvertip center Julius Miettinen, a native of Finland, with the 40th pick. Their first three picks were all centers, really loading up at that position. Catton has played 3 seasons for the Chiefs, breaking through in 2023-24 with 54 goals and 62 assists to finish fourth in the WHL in points. He's a native of Saskatoon. Mettinen had 31 goals and 36 and assists in his first WHL campaign, ranking second among WHL rookies. Then the Kraken went out and made its big splash in free agency when it opened on Monday. They signed defenseman Brandon Montour to a 7-year, $50 million contract, after he helped the Florida Panthers to the Stanley Cup trophy, and Vegas center Chandler Stephenson to a 7-year, $43.75 million deal. Both of those guys are age 30, so these deals will take them through age 37 on the back end. And that's one of the things in the NHL, because of the fact that you can have such long contracts, basically you try to get more current value by signing old players to super long contracts that inevitably are not going to age well at all. Montour enjoyed a breakout season in 2023, finishing 12th in Norris Trophy voting after recording 57 assists and ranking in the top five among defensemen in points. Stephenson's a two-time Cup winner with the Washington Capitals as a rookie in 2023 with the Golden Knights, when he was also an All-Star for the only time. Had 10 goals and 10 assists during that playoff run, but then scored just 51 points in 75 games last season. Kraken still probably excited about his 16.5% shooting percentage, better than any Kraken regular managed last season. In fact, only Tomas Tatar was above 13.4%, whereas Stephenson is at 14.7% for his career. The knock is he's dependent on being set up rather than creating offense, but a team that needed finishing help, that does seem quite useful in the short term. Vince Dunn is the only incumbent Kraken player who's going to be paid more in terms of annual salary than either Montour or Stephenson, but the Kraken do have yet to re-sign restricted free agent Matty Beniers. In addition to Beniers, they also extended qualifying offers to Ellie Tolvanen and Firebird Pietro Seppälä. Kailer Yamamoto was not tendered. Kraken currently sitting on $8.5 million in cap space after their spending spree.
All right.
So this all seems like spending a lot in free agency, especially on 30-year-olds, seems like a great way to try to be relevant now, with massive long-term consequences on the back end. So there you go. The anti Mariners in that regard, I suppose. Tatar signed with the New Jersey Devils among Kraken free agents. And then also I don't know why the NHL didn't space this out so that they might have another news cycle. But the 2024-25 schedule is out. The Kraken will open by hosting a Tuesday matinee
Oh
against
my,
the
wow,
St.
they
Louis
really did it
Blues.
all. They had the draft, free agency, the schedule, coaches were being hired. It all happened. That was your NHL offseason.
It was, yeah. They're just, everybody's going home, taking a break after this. The Blues is the first game of an ESPN opening day triple header on October 8th.
There we go.
So good news, the Mariners will not be in the playoffs, so you won't be busy that afternoon.
I just, this tanking argument about the Orioles, like, it's just Adley Rutschman, which obviously is an important player. Like, do you think they were tanking when they got Anthony Santander in the Rule 5 draft? Or when they randomly just purchased Ryan O'Hearn's contract? Jordan Westberg was the 30th pick in the draft. Gunnar Henderson was the second round pick.
I'm not saying they didn't have good
Develop
management as well.
A player, Mariners, literally one.
Well, we thought they had developed one. Again, it's position player. They've developed many pitchers, so many pitchers, all the pitchers. All right, the Seattle Sounders, the Cardiac Sounders, did it again on Saturday, going behind the lowly Chicago Fire in the 30th minute before coming back, getting the equalizer from Albert Rusnak in the 57th minute and the winner from Rusnak in stoppage time, both on penalties. The two goals came after talisman Paul Rothrock replaced Alex Roldan coming back from concussion protocol at halftime. Rothrock, who continues his hot streak, won the first penalty. Jordan Morris, the second in stoppage time. Sounders also got Pedro de la Vega back on the pitch for the final 20-plus minutes of this one. Very encouraging sign. And they again dominated in terms of expected goals with 2.5 to 1 for Chicago. This game, and a story that broke after we recorded last week, was played without Nuhu and Raul Diaz, who were away from the team all week after an incident complaining about playing time to Brian Schmetzer in the locker room after the previous weekend's win over FC Dallas. In that one, Rui Diaz came on as a substitute for the second straight game, helping key that comeback, while Nuhu was pulled for the game in the 73rd minute. Remains to be seen exactly what the plan for them as they return to training this week. The win moved the Sounders into a tie for eighth in the West with Vancouver just above the playoff line with 1.33 points per match. Sounders will wrap up a three-game homestand on Saturday against the New England Revolution. On Tuesday, they return to The following Tuesday, they returned to U.S. Open Cup play, visiting USL Championship side Sacramento Republic in the quarterfinals. Sacramento currently sits second in the Western Conference table.
It's kind of interesting having, I mean, obviously the Sounders have kind of turned things around here, right? And, you know, their chances of making the playoffs a month ago, very different than their chances are now of
Again,
making the playoffs.
The curves are going in opposite directions.
I don't know why I'm the, like, the cold hard logic person here. I don't like this role, and you're like, it has to be a curse. You're like, explain to me how the Sounders are good now and the Mariners are bad. But the thing that's a little shocking was the Nuhu and Rui Diaz news happening in the midst of this win streak for the Sounders.
Right,
it's a little
yes.
bit like, yes, I understand that players want to play, right? Rui Diaz obviously moving into a different phase of his career. Nuhu, I'm not sure, but like Rui Diaz.
I think the word with Nuhu is that he feels like he's been scapegoated a little bit during the team's strong start or slow
by,
start.
By who though? Like by the media?
Well, by
Brian
Schmetzer.
Schmetzer?
I don't think it's the media. There was not a locker room incident with the media in Nuhu. It was only Brian Schmetzer.
Fair enough. But it's interesting that it happened as the team was kind of turning their season around. I do think these things sometimes can be good catalysts. Like sometimes there's stuff that's left unsaid that it's important to get out in the open. If it leads to a locker room blow up, c'est la vie. But also sometimes expressing emotions is more important than just having them fester.
Men will literally have locker room blow-ups instead of going to therapy. I think it's what you were saying there.
Argue about how far away Fife is.
Fife is a long ways away.
We'll start an entire podcast. Do it during the toasts.
Your sense of distance is warped. I'm going to go a lot farther for cookies than you are. I will say that.
I was going to travel. You should have just told me to go get the cookies. I would have gone to go get the cookies today. What was I doing? Waiting in line at Costco?
Well, if you had offered this earlier, I did call De Laurentiis, but by the time I called, they were already out of the chocolate chip.
What time did you call?
Not until four. I mean, again, this is very late in the day.
I mean, I don't know if I could have actually gone.
I
There was
was recording the low
a
post.
really long line at Costco.
So it was a day that ended in Y. No, I guess it's before the 4th of July.
The
Yeah,
3rd of July. It's like a
why would you
notably
go
busy day.
to Costco?
I needed a car battery.
Oh, yes. Heard all about that story.
Wait, did you really?
Well, no, but you were with mom when it happened, and then you two called me. That's the story. Seattle Reign, despite Rose Lavelle scoring for Gotham in her first game against her former team, the Reign scratched out a point on Sunday, equalizing in the 98th minute via a Gotham FC own goal. The Reign host the Utah Royals this Sunday in their last game before the NWSL regular season breaks for the Olympics. Reign set to add Haiti captain Nerilia Mondesir from Montpellier in France, with CBS
Okay.
Sports reporting an estimated transfer fee of $200,000. The 25-year-old attacker has 18 goals for the national team, had 5 goals and 4 assists in league play from Montpellier last season after scoring 9 goals in 2022-23. OptiStats rank her in the 89th percentile among attacking midfielders and wingers in successful take-ons, so loves to dribble at defenders and try to go by them. Most likely slots in is a winger for the Reign.
Okay, making some
Yeah,
moves.
exciting. Well, making a move in the standings, I mean, I guess not because the top three were far ahead, but the Seattle Storm have won 4 consecutive games now to start their homestand, all of them by double figures. They beat Dallas twice by a combined 45 points in
I was going to
back-to-back
turn this
games.
game on. I actually did for a few minutes, but I was like, it's over. They're up by 30.
Did you get to see some Nick and Mule?
I did. I actually did.
Jordan Horston is thriving as a starter right now. She moved into the starting lineup at the beginning of this 4-game winning streak. She's averaging 8.8 points, 6.5 rebounds, 3.5 assists, 1.8 steals. Storm have 20 plus assists as a team in each of these 4 wins. The ball is popping out there, and everything's coming together with some practice time in this homestand. The Storm waived Kiana Williams on Tuesday ahead of salaries guaranteed for the full season in the WNBA. Williams beaten out by Nika Mule apparently for the third point guard job after both have only played in blowouts this season, basically. Williams was spotted by Circling Seattle Sports at Tuesday's Mariners game, so maybe she could stick around on a 7-day contract after this, which would give the Storm a little more flexibility if they felt like they needed cover at another position due to injuries.
The only offensive player spotted at Seattle's Tuesday's Mariners
Oh,
game.
oh. Well, Kiana Williams, more power in terms of long distance shots than the Mariners have, I guess that's for sure. All right, let's do a midway check-in. We're technically 1 game before the midpoint of the Storm season. They are 13-6, fourth in the standings. Vegas closing fast on a 5-game winning streak and even in the loss column. So with 5 elite teams, Vegas, New York, Connecticut, Minnesota, and the Storm, and only 4 able to host playoff series, the big question is whether, if the Aces catch the Storm, whether they can catch presumably either Minnesota or Connecticut to finish in the top 4. Minnesota now just 1 game out of the Storm at 14-5, albeit with the tiebreaker thanks to their 3 head-to-head wins. Connecticut also, after their undefeated start, falling back towards the pack a little bit. The BPI projections from ESPN had the Storm finishing with home court advantage 55% of the time, so slightly better than a 50-50 proposition. And they drop below fifth just 1.5% of the time.
So it's basically fifth or bust for the Storm, but
No, top four
with,
bust.
well, I mean, like, yes,
Avoid
basically
fifth?
their floor is fifth.
Yes, very
That's what
unlikely
I'm
they would
saying.
fall below that.
For Minnesota, obviously playing worse lately, when you look at that 13-6 record, half of those losses have been against Minnesota.
Correct.
And it was during the beginning part of the season when Minnesota was playing very, very well, most of those losses. So, I mean, two were within, they were the first two games, right?
One of them in overtime, double overtime in Minneapolis.
So I think you'd have to look at it and say, obviously, Las Vegas is a good team overall. Like Las Vegas, similar to the Astros, right? Like that's they're going to be in the top four, almost no doubt about it.
And even a more clear injury situation. They haven't lost since Chelsea Gray came back to the lineup.
Minnesota is the team. And you would have said preseason, you know, they were similar, but it felt like the Storm preseason were probably more likely to be in that spot than Minnesota anyway. And with how they've been playing and given the losses that they've had, I feel like the Storm, like sure, 55%, but it feels to me like they're pretty likely to be in that top four.
I mean, I have to go double check my preseason projections. I think I might have had Minnesota ahead of the Storm. I know I had Connecticut and obviously Vegas and New York. So I think it's actually kind of lining up, not necessarily in the exact order, but is the exact top five that I have. Although, I mean, the big difference...
You're going to mention that on an NBA draft broadcast?
Yes, I will. Yeah. Although, like, I had, you know, all of those teams save New York and Las Vegas a lot closer to 500 than they actually are. Like, they really separated from the rest of the league. Phoenix had a nice little stretch there, handed the Storm one of those six losses after Brittany Griner came back, but they're still hovering at 500 at 10-10. So we're fifth in offensive rating, third in defensive rating right now. Not far behind Connecticut for second. Those three teams, Minnesota, Connecticut, and Seattle, the surprise teams or the teams that have jumped into the mix, all top three in defensive rating.
Yeah, and I don't know if they're a surprise team. I think the biggest surprise is how close they are to New York and Vegas.
Right.
And the fact that at this point, if you would have said the Storm, like if literally the only information you had was that the Storm are ahead of Vegas in the standings at the midway point, your assumption would be that the Storm are maybe the best team in the league.
I see. Yeah, it was probably second at worst.
So I think that's been the surprise, is the kind of the parity at the top. And you don't necessarily look at it overall. The rosters, the raw talent on the rosters for New York and Vegas is still better than almost any of those other teams. And that's going to matter once you get to the playoffs. But the parity is definitely interesting at the very least.
It's different than last year, where it just kind of seemed like we were playing out the string before the New York Las Vegas
final. It was an inevitability. Is Indiana, unrelated to this, is Indiana, are they in the mix for the playoffs? Where do they sit?
They are currently a half game out of the final playoff spot.
Because I do think it'd be pretty fun having Caitlin Clark in the playoffs. Knowing how Caitlin Clark has played in the NCAA tournaments these last couple of years. Like, I think it could be interesting.
Yeah. So related to that, upcoming for the Storm, another home set of back-to-back games against the Chicago Sky, who saw Angel Reese win Rookie of the Month for June. She's currently... has the longest single season, or at least has tied the longest single season double-double streak in WNBA history, and was selected, as we mentioned, for Team WNBA in the All-Star game by coaches ahead of Ezzie Magbegor, which is interesting timing for Angel Reese and the Sky to come to town.
There's a reality that the All-Star game is, like, you want the most popular players there.
I think it's a good outcome for the WNBA to have Angel Reese there, yeah.
It is not, like, people treat these things as if they're altruistic. And that's the thing that I've been thinking about a lot. As if there's, like, some, like, overarching, like, the people belong. If they play well, they belong there.
Well, we
and
it's do like, use these as a measure of a player's career. So it's important to get it right from that standpoint. I've always thought you should pick one team from that and then pick another team that's actually who we want to see play in the All-Star game. We don't have to be the same two teams.
That kind of makes sense to me.
Ezzie, by the way, probably wouldn't have been able to play in the All-Star game. I don't know what the timing is, but she's got to go meet Australia for her national team.
It is
they could have just picked her
game, though.
They could have just picked her and made Angel Reese the injury the replacement on the roster.
Wait, what pick was Angel Reese?
The seventh.
That's what I was saying. I swear I said this to you last year. Why did the Storm not just and look fine? The outcome was great that they had long term, though. If you put Angel Reese on this roster, maybe they wouldn't have been able to sign both Skylar Diggins-Smith and Nneka Ogwumike without that trade.
No.
So I get it overall, but damn if they had Angel Reese, if they just taken her with that pick.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of teams that drafted, including the LA Sparks, who got that pick from the Storm, who might be thinking, we should have drafted Angel Reese.
But it's not like it was rocket science. She was literally beat Caitlin Clark in the NCAA championship. This is not like retroactively going back and being Gunnar Henderson was a second round pick. Angel Reese was the second most popular player in all of college basketball, and people missed it. So that one, like, that's not the same as going back into a different draft and being like, well, we should have taken this player. You could have taken the second most popular player who played well. And I don't even really understand why she'd fallen.
There was a mysterious suspension at the start of the season, or at least absence from the team, that certainly seemed to play into it. But people worried about the fact that she doesn't have any shooting range. And so far, that has not hurt Chicago offensively. And her rebounding has really stood out.
I think that one falls under reasons.
So I thought Angel Reese was going to be the fourth best player in this draft. I thought she went way too low at seventh, but she has exceeded my expectations for sure.
And
to
the
be
Storm
playing
had picked...
as well. Correct.
It's fine. Obviously, the outcome has worked out well, at least in the short term. And
it will be a bummer if Neko Okumeke goes and signs with the Golden State Valkyries next season.
The Valkyries?
Yes, that's their name.
I don't know how I feel about that one. But people do treat all-star games and things like that as if it's like it has to be the best players or whatever for that season. It's just like, does it? Like, that's not exactly what this is. There's a reality that, like, the point is having stars in the game.
That's reflected in the fan voting. That's not how the coaches vote. It has not been how coaches have voted historically. So, Chicago is tied for the seventh playoff spot and eighth playoff spot. They're with the Atlanta Dream right now at 7-11, half game ahead of the Fever, who are 8-13. All right, it's a surprising amount of UW men's basketball news for July. First off, we got the news that the Apple Cup series will continue in men's hoops with a 2-year home-and-home agreement between UW and Washington State. So that's good news. Then, according to John Chepkovich of Draft Express, the Huskies added a late commit Wednesday in 6'7" forward Dominique Diamond, a native of Côte d'Ivoire, playing in France.
Okay.
Diamond averaged 16 points, 6 rebounds, 1.8 steals in the French second division last season while making his first division debut with Blois, seeing 66... Blois? I don't know how to pronounce that
Blois.
Name.
Blois.
Seeing 66 minutes of action with the first team. He recently turned age 19. A little surprising to the extent that we thought the Huskies' scholarships were fully committed for, so spoken for, so we'll see what transpires there.
They'll figure it out. Okay. You have live feedback from France on this prospect.
I was sending some texts. I have not yet received the information about it. So, we'll maybe pass that along on next week's pod if I get that.
Or join the Discord if you're not in the Discord.
Yeah, the French sources may be mentioned there. UW also, we mentioned Abdul Gaddy Jr. They're filling out the coaching staff with former Utah associate head coach Tommy Connor. He served alongside UW assistants Andy Hill and DeMarlo Slocum for the Utes before being let go when Larry Krystkowiak was fired in 2021. Has not coached since, so interesting to see him get back into college hoops.
It's 9:15 in France right now. Bastille Day isn't for another 10 days. Respond to the text, people. 9:15 a.m. is early enough, it's late enough in the day that you should be responding to texts about this prospect so we can have feedback live on the PeltonCast right now. Look, we're celebrating a holiday tomorrow. It's 10 more days for you, France. I like that I had you wait for that. I was like, hold up. Something
so that you could look up when Bastille Day was? I mean, I'm impressed that you knew it was in July.
Literally, the Simpsons episode where they mentioned Bastille Day, where they go to the beach. I feel like it's done more for Bastille Day than almost anything else since the revolution.
Yeah, I don't think that. Okay.
At least for Americans.
Some more UW sports news. Softball transfer update. All 8 former Huskies ended up transferring to either Big 12 or SEC programs.
It's like, whatever.
Olivia Johnson and Sydney Peters both went to Texas A&M. Kinsey Fiedler to Tennessee. Riley Holtorf to Florida. Brooklyn Carter went to Baylor. Alana Johnson, Texas Tech. Sydney Stewart to Arizona. So
cool.
None Great. Of them will Love be competing that. Against the Huskies in the Big Ten
is
the, next
is
year.
There NIL money coming into softball at this point, or what do we think? Are players getting paid in that way?
I'm sure there is, but not to the same degree as men's and women's basketball and football.
I would just say that if there's one place that players are getting paid to play college softball, it is probably Texas A&M. Knowing what I know about the amount of money that is going to the Texas A&M program overall,
well,
I would expect, like, that is shocking. It's so funny to me because, like, Texas A&M, they've always been a fine program. Like, when we were kids, it was just like Texas A&M was nothing, right? We never once considered Texas A&M, even though they were just pretty solid.
A distant afterthought behind Texas and Oklahoma in that region.
And now I believe that they are probably the richest program in the country. It is such a strange situation. The amount of money that's around.
That can't
Texas
be true.
A&M
There's
sports.
No way they could be a richer program than Texas. Can they?
I mean, I saw a ranking of like revenue for last year from college. I think this might've just been specifically college football programs, but I believe Texas A&M was second in the country.
In revenue? Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that is very surprising.
I don't know. Something is happening at Texas A&M. I mean,
well, speaking of Texas
A&M, it's a lot of rich oil money for what it's worth.
I mean, I think they have some of that in Oklahoma as well. UW baseball coach Jason Kelly has departed for the pitching coach job at Texas A&M after two seasons in Seattle. He's rejoining new A&M coach Michael Early, who was an assistant with him at Arizona State beforehand. There's been a lot of hand-wringing. We mentioned the new gymnastics coach leaving for Iowa. Obviously, Kalen DeBoer. Am I missing a UW head coach who left? I know it's been four in the past.
I mean,
past
one was fired.
Not counting those that were not by their choice in Mike Hopkins' case. I think people are freaking out about this a little too much and underestimating the element of, well, yeah, all of these coaches got hired by a different athletic director that's in place. And that's a big element of comfort for a coach.
Yes.
Especially depending on how long your contract is, which, you know, if you're a first-time head coach at UW baseball, you probably weren't getting the same deal that Jed Fish got to coach the football team. So I don't think it's like such a, oh no, UW athletics is in a terrible spot. It does probably say something about baseball and softball in the Big 12 and SEC in particular. As we discussed on the phone the other night, it just matters more there.
Just means more. Baseball in the SEC is, that's it. It's the elite. It's the pinnacle. There's the big two in college football between the Big Ten and the SEC. In baseball, there's a big one and the Big 12 is behind it. But I think a pitching coach job in the SEC is a better job than a head coach job in most schools in the Big Ten. When you look at it, seeing it was two teams from the SEC who are in the national championship this year, the amount of fervor that there is around college baseball, like watching Tennessee play college baseball, it's unlike anything that I've ever seen from any Pac-12 school. Being at UW is just like, I mean, it is not a fun experience. Children's baseball is a more fun experience than UW baseball, right? It is not even, they're not even in conversation with each other. And UW men's baseball is way below UW softball. So I think softball matters more. I'm not sure moving to the Big Ten what the case will be for that. UW will be fine at softball. I'm not nervous about it. UW baseball?
I have some concerns in the short term. I don't have those concerns about
exactly.
UW softball.
That's what I'm
term.
Saying. UW softball will be back long term. UW baseball, there's no real program being built to speak of, and maybe it's something that they'll eventually care about, but it kind of felt like under Jason Kelly is the coach's name, right?
Yep.
Under Jason Kelly, it felt like something was being built and then it wasn't. So, and I think if you're Jason Kelly and you're like, A, I can go to Texas A&M where I don't know if we have salary details. I wouldn't be shocked if the salary was higher to be the pitching coach rather than the head coach. And being the pitching coach there, if you're successful at Texas A&M, could lead to an SEC head coaching job, which is significantly better than a Pac-12 head coaching job or a Big Ten head coaching job. So, I mean, to me, this move, maybe it's a step back to make a step forward, But UW baseball was very bad this year, and I think Jason Kelly may have seen the writing on the wall as well.
Yeah, and I think there's probably also a recruiting element that, you know, you're just not producing as much talent in the state of Washington, inevitably.
It's fucking Texas and baseball.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's not even close. There aren't that many Corbin Carrolls out there, you know? But in Texas, there were a million Corbin Carrolls. It's like the German when they're talking about Julian, yes, whatever, Julian Green. It's like, we have
pond.
A whole, yeah, we have a whole sea of Julian Greens, and that's baseball in Texas. They have enough players to have a very good Texas A&M team, a very good Texas team, and very good teams throughout the rest of the South. So to me, this has nothing to do with, I think people are, because UW is moving to the Big Ten, people are attributing everything that happens to UW as it being because of UW moving to the Big Ten. And in reality, shit just changes, and college sports is changing very, very rapidly. UW moving to the Big Ten is part of that wave of what's happening in college sports, but it's happening in a much greater scale than just UW going to the Big Ten. So, top schools in athletic revenue in 2023 per Sportico. Number one, you could probably guess who this one is. I'll tell you, they're a Big Ten school.
Alabama? Michigan?
Nope. Probably
Ohio
the most
State?
Important program in the entire country. Ohio State is number one. Number two, by just $400,000 less, is Texas A&M.
How is that possible? Because that's, like, you talk about oil money. I mean, that's to a degree, but that's also just selling tickets. And I guess, is it because of the fact that they do it over so many different programs?
I don't know. Texas, it's just fucking happening at Texas.
I don't know.
A&M.
Someone write an expose on that. I'll read it.
The top 10 is Ohio State, Texas A&M, Texas, Michigan, Georgia, Nebraska, Penn State, Tennessee, LSU, Bama.
I mean, is there like some sort of 1 year thing? Because Texas has to have a bigger stadium, and then, like, right?
I don't know. I'm just saying, Texas A&M, it is a program that people care about. People are very invested in Texas A&M being. My favorite part was UW was number 22, Oregon right behind them at number 23.
There you go. Texas Royal Stadium seats 100,000.
What is Texas A&M seat?
Whatever it is, I'm confident it's not 100,000. No, 102,000.
There you go.
Wow.
I think you're underestimating. You don't pay as much attention to all the other shit around college football as I do. Texas A&M is like,
really try my hardest not to.
I think Ohio State is the most important program in the country, and I deceptively think Texas A&M is like top five program in the country.
They have 72,000 students. That's a lot of students, man.
It's a strange one. Because again, they literally have never been like,
yeah, they have 20,000 more students than UT. Huh. Wow. Well, there you go.
There you go. You learn something new about Texas A&M every day. Every Pelton cast.
All right. Well, the state of Washington may not be producing all that much baseball talent for Jason Kelly's team, or former team, but they are producing some football talent this year. We are going to talk briefly about Husky recruiting in the aggregate. Huskies up to 19 prospects in their 2025 recruiting class, including 5 4-star prospects, according to the 24/7 Sports Composite. They are currently the 19th rated class by that measure, and it's a much heavier Northwest field than the Kalen DeBoer era, with 4 prospects from Washington, including the top 2 24/7 Sports consensus recruits, Bethel linebacker Zadrius Rainey-Sale, who recommitted after previously committing to DeBoer's staff, and Auburn Riverside linebacker Jonathan Epperson, and then 2 more from Oregon. So still a long ways to go till signing day. A lot of chance for recruits to change their minds. But so far, so good, I would say, for Jed Fish's first full class.
Where are you seeing them ranked as number 19? This is the 2024 recruiting rankings?
No, 2025.
Oh, okay, 2025 recruiting rankings. Got it. It's nice to see they're still behind 1, 2, 3, 4 Rutgers. Wow. 5.
Wow. What's going on
6.
In Rutgers? Rutgers has a really good, they have 2 players in like the top 5 in the men's basketball recruiting class as well.
Kind of wild. Six Big Ten schools with USC right behind them. So the way that UW, I just don't think recruiting matters. Ultimately,
it matters. They're going to have to outperform their recruiting to be as good as they want to be. But like whether they're in 20th or whether they're in 30th, I think does matter.
Maybe it might matter. But you look at like the Arizona classes, Teterell McMillan and Noah Fifita were highly recruited players. Or Teterell McMillan was. Noah Fifita was not even necessarily a highly recruited player. The way that UW does this and the way that they've done it basically forever, anytime that UW has been successful, is never top 10 classes. It's just not a thing that's going to happen at UW. I think that they can compete at, they could be top 15. They can maybe like eke in the top 10, but they're never going to be as high as probably Oregon is going to be. You know, if we're being honest with ourselves, the amount of money that's going to be spent on NIL is just not going to be as high. Dan Lanning has something good going recruiting wise at Oregon. Jed Fish and whomever is the coach of UW has to outcoach these people. They still, it always has to be the OKG types. And I think that's what Chris Peterson did really well. I think that's what Kalen DeBoer did really well. And that's the thing that heading into the season, it's funny to me when people are like, oh, UW is not in whatever, like all these different rankings that are coming. And I'm like, dog, who cares right now? I don't give a fuck about these rankings, right? This isn't like, this isn't Fangraphs telling us what's going to happen. You know, this isn't Fangraphs with the computer seeing the future. This is journalists judging things. And I mean, ultimately we don't know.
There is an FBI projection out there that we talked about a few weeks back.
But it's still mostly around a lot of players who've never even played on these teams who are like 19, 20 years old. And the things that are going to matter is having experienced quarterbacks overall. Like, look, do I think that Colin Klein is going to do well at Ohio State? Do I think that, oh my God, can't think of the quarterback who Oregon signed. Like, the more experienced quarterbacks are going to do well. And I think that's the thing that we've learned overall is that experienced quarterback is the number one thing you can have. Well, what? Coming into the University of Washington is a quarterback who started four fucking years in Will Rogers. And I think people are underestimating him just a little bit. And what I've said is before Kalen DeBoer was head coach, the expectations for that UW team were not high. In his first year as head coach, Michael Penix wasn't the number eight pick in the draft at the time. Michael Penix was, oh, he had some pretty good seasons at Indiana. If he can stay healthy, maybe he'll be okay. And that to me is just like, that's how UW is built, is with players who are not, Roma Dunze wasn't a five-star recruit. Like, it is turning these players, finding the gems, coaching them, and turning them into players who were littered throughout the NFL draft this year, much higher than their counterparts at many of these other schools, especially first-round picks. So, I see these recruiting rankings, and I'm like, it's fine. Like, half of the class is going to transfer, and the other half, they're either going to coach or they're not going to be good. Like, that's the reality. They have to be able to coach these players and put them in the right position and build up the program.
Dylan Gabriel is the quarterback who transferred to Oregon.
Yes, Dylan Gabriel. I'm going to say that I forgot that one on purpose.
We have gotten this far in the podcast without wishing everyone a happy 4th of July. It is the 4th as we're recording this. Hope everyone manages to celebrate it safely and have a good time.
Is that how we're wrapping it up?
I think so.
When are we eulogizing the Pac-12? August? Is that when we'll do it?
I believe that is when the transition becomes official.
Okay. So, but can we at least pour one out? Can we retroactively go back and pour one out for the Pac-12 network? We'll do that at the end here.
Okay. Yeah, we can, which obviously went off the air, signed off at the end of June. It was fitting. It was 2 years, you know, July 1st was 2 years to the day from USC and UCLA announcing that they were heading to the Big Ten and beginning this era of college football realignment as we know it. So
kind of shocking to watch. I mean, I was there watching. They did the last broadcast and basically every game was Oregon State and Wazoo beating other Pac-12 teams who are leaving. I kind of like it. I like the pettiness of it.
Oh, I respect it.
I sat and I watched the Snow Bowl, that 1992 Apple Cup, and I was like, honestly, I don't even, like, first off, the shit happened 32 years ago. So I'm not going to be, I mean, I guess it was 31, right? But
31 and a half, yes. Closer to 32.
I'm not going to be upset about a football game, that many football games that happened 32 years ago. Look, there's some Oregon losses. There's one in particular still not okay with.
To have been part of the Snow Bowl in Big End UW's program, even though they didn't win it.
How so?
Because A, it was like just a fun, really fun, memorable game. And B, like the whole point of why they were playing it is because it was so amazing for them to beat UW. UW doesn't play like some random Apple Cup, you know, I mean, maybe 2003, but it's never that surprising for UW to beat Washington yes. State.
Yeah. They're not showing the numerous victories against Mike Leach.
Oh, Jimmy Lake is somewhere watching those. We're living the glory days.
It was pretty fun to watch that last broadcast, and also just shocking. We lived through all of it, but the whole Pac-12 era, we'll talk about it again in a month, but for the Pac-12 network era, it was never pretty. I wouldn't say that we loved the Pac-12 network at any point, but it was also sad to see it go. And I like that they went out just a little petty.
Yeah, great respect for the full-time Pac-12 employees who did terrific work.
So. And, you know, Wazoo and Oregon State, for them, it's so funny because now I'm like, those are my dogs. Wazoo and Oregon State, I've never loved each of those programs more than I do right now. So giving them that moment to have on the very last day of the Pac-12 network, it was pretty fun to see.
All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Are you actually going to Kyle's?
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear how that is.
I feel like everybody's treating it like it's so shocking. Jan is like doing all this work to like prep us going. I'm just like, we're just going to Kyle's house. It's not that big of a deal.
Well, look, Jan treats anything like